This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Piki mai kake mai. I'm Alison Balance, and welcome to this Our Changing World podcast from RNZ, which is all about urban bats. Our guide is producer William Ray.
A few weeks ago, I was visiting my dad in Hamilton, and I went for a walk down beside the Waikato River. It was late afternoon, maybe a half hour or so from sunset, and I heard this weird noise. I kept walking, and it got louder and louder. I turned the corner and saw something really strange. A group of about 50 people, all holding these weird devices. They looked a bit like walkie-talkies. They were blasting out static at full volume, and everyone was staring up at the sky. My first thought was this was some kind of weird space cult. I figured these people must be waiting for the UFOs to come and beam them up or something. I asked them what they were looking for, and they said bats. Specifically, they were looking for the critically endangered New Zealand long-tailed bat, one of only two native mammals in this country. There's also a short-tailed bat that's also critically endangered. It turned out I'd run into a Bat Fun Day, an event run by Project Echo, a group which advocates and educates about bats in Hamilton City. Now, I grew up in Hamilton, just a couple of kilometres from the spot, and I had no idea there were bats here or anywhere else in the city. So, a few weeks later, I arranged to meet up with Project Echo for my own personal bat-spotting tour. We met at Hammond Park in Rivoli, at the southern end of the city near the Hamilton Gardens. The first members of Project Echo I meet are Selena Ghazali and Jerry Kelly. The rest of the group are running late.
Hello.
Hello.
Sorry, I'm William.
Selena.
Nice to meet you.
How are you? And this is Jerry.
Oh, he's got an old combi van. Awesome.
I would make a Batmobile joke, but I reckon it's too...
It's an awesome car.
Oh, yeah, but I've just been bloody under it today trying to change transmission fluid and bloody someone has really reached the Allen nut.
Selena, Jerry and I start walking downriver along the boardwalk through a patch of native forest called Hammond Bush on the river's edge. Along the way, we run into another member of Project Echo.
Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Selena. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, I'm William.
Andrew.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
You too.
Andrew, was it?
Yes.
What's your second name, Andrew?
Steich.
So what's your part in this, Andrew?
I'm the Department of Conservation, which is a partner of Project Echo.
Right, okay.
And I do a lot of advocacy for bats through my job at DOC.
Right, right. That's crazy, because until I came across this whole thing, I had no idea that you could even find bats in cities. I thought that they were strictly a sort of depths of the native bush kind of thing.
That's what everyone thought.
Yeah,
so this is a big learning, it's a big culture change.
So how long has that been sort of discovered? Like, how recent is that kind of discovery?
Angie de Kraut did her PhD here.
Yeah.
And when she came to do her PhD from Auckland University, because she'd read an account of long-tailed bats at Jubilee Bush.
Mm.
And we never found any there. I don't think we've detected any there since.
No,
but that was the start of her kind of like surveying, and then she went kind of out from Jubilee Bush and went further afield, and you know, was checking out gullies in southern parts of the city, and came across a big maternity roost.
How long ago was that?
That would have been 2005, I think.
So it is all pretty recent then.
Yeah. There has been kind of anecdotal evidence, like people fishing down here Up at the Hamilton Gardens, people were kind of, oh, there's, you know, something out in the evening that's not swallows. Nothing had really been proven, you know. No one had actually taken any, you know, evidential accounts or monitored or, yeah. So it was quite ad hoc.
Andrew Steich says native bats have only survived near Hamilton thanks to a few tiny patches of native bush around the city.
The reason they're critically endangered is that little populations have been blinking out all over the country. So some places were more thoroughly cleared of vegetation than others. By luck, the bats have survived around Hamilton, really, because it is by luck. They've survived in a few trees and hung on. Because there's not much original vegetation left around here, so that is amazing that they have survived to date.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of that original vegetation, we're walking through some now.
Yeah, this is some of the very thin vestiges of original vegetation in Hamilton.
Hammond Bush is what's known as remnant bush, native forest that's been left mostly undisturbed by human beings. This type of forest is critical for bats because they prefer to roost in holes left behind when trees start to die and shed their branches. Native trees like rimu and totara can take hundreds of years before they get to that point, which means that bats need old forests. Recently planted natives are no good. Luckily, it turns out there are alternatives. Long-tailed bats are happy to roost in faster-growing introduced species like oak, pine and eucalyptus.
Yeah, like this gully is a classic example. Up the head of this gully, we've planted eucalyptus species to replace the large eucalyptus that are going to, you know, continually start to fail. And the only reason for that was because they're potential roost trees that would be quicker grown than a lot of the natives that we've been planting as well. Lots of natives planted as well, but yeah, it was...
Is the problem that the natives just don't shed their branches quite as early in the life cycle?
They take a lot longer to grow. So when you don't have many trees to start with, and you don't want to wait 300 years to form new ones, so you've got to plant something normally exotic, and some of the exotic trees actually can be quite beneficial for them. Some oak trees, I love them.
Yeah, yeah.
That tolerance for exotic trees means you end up finding bats in some pretty surprising places around Hamilton. The biggest hotspot is at the Narrows Christian Camp, right under the main flight path for Hamilton Airport. So let's take a quick detour from our bat-spotting excursion and meet Al Belcher, who's been running the camp for the last 6 years.
We always see them flying around these days, not far off the height of where those birds are.
Yeah, yeah.
Usually you see them all through here at night and through the other set. And then there's a big roost further up in the oak trees, and there's a couple in these ones, so they're kind of all over the park.
Can we go have a look at the oak trees?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it is the kind of trees they'd be after, sort of old, gnarled-looking places.
They tend to like the dangerous trees, so the ones that are sort of hollowed out.
Yeah.
So you can see with these acacias, a lot of the branches are broken, and they tend to rot from the inside out, so they provide these nice hollow cavities for them to roost in.
Right, right.
We have to clear them out once in a while, but trying to preserve them as much as possible, because these roosts are pretty rare.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of them around. The feedback we've got has been that this is probably the most intensified site, so they've found the largest number of bats roosting here that they've ever found.
Well, in New Zealand?
For this style of bat, yeah.
For
this type of bat, yeah.
That's amazing.
Up here in the Oaks, the largest roost was, I think it was 39 bats they came across, which apparently is a record for them.
Yeah. So is that just in these trees just here? Well, there's some guys with chainsaws over here. So hopefully they know what they're doing.
Well, that's actually part of the problem in here is we're just working on a plan with a few organizations to get a replanting scheme in place, because these big oaks and acacias, especially through this area, because this is probably old dry riverbed, the soil is quite sandy.
Right.
So every once in a while, like that's a good example, that stump there, you'll get a full-grown tree, you'll just topple over.
I guess it's sort of a balance of not wanting to... destroy the bat habitat, but you can't have sort of old dangerous trees hanging around.
Yeah, that's exactly the problem that we're trying to work through now. We want to do our part to preserve as much as we can, but the health and safety factor when you're a youth camp and you got kids everywhere,
yeah,
it's a little bit different to it just being an abandoned forest that you could just let naturally fall over.
speaking of the dangers and benefits of dead trees, back in Hammond Bush, I got talking with Jerry from Project Zero. Jerry's an arborist, so a big part of his job is chopping down dead or dying trees which are at risk of falling down or dropping branches. But he says he's increasingly trying to find less invasive methods which keep both bats and people happy.
In Europe, they actually, with dismantling trees, they leave a lot of the trunk up and they cut the roots into the trunk branches and just leave them as a ecological, you know, kind of monument, I suppose. And yeah, and they, a lot of like bird roosts and bat roosts. So
I guess that's something that people could do in their backyard. You know, if they've got an old tree that they need that needs to come down, leave the trunk up and cut some holes in it, could make good habitat.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the other thing we really need to start kind of just getting into our heads, that dead trees in the landscape are okay. Obviously, there's safety things around, you know, town and power lines and things, but down the road, we've got an electrician. When he moved in, and he said, oh, look, I've got a gum tree I want you to look at. I'm looking at putting a little hut under it, you know, a little office. And so I said, oh, yeah, I'll come and have a look. Went down and had a look, and it was kind of like some dead branches on it and kind of over the, at the top of a gully. And I was saying to him, well, these are the kind of trees that are perfect for bats, you know. We've just been doing a whole lot of bat stuff. And he goes, oh, yeah, I've been watching them sitting on the back porch. And I'm like, what? And so he'd been working in Aussie doing a lot of, you know, the kind of mining stuff. And,
yeah.
And he just thought it was quite common. And he'd been actually just coming home in the evening like now and just sitting on the back porch having a beer and watching the bats come in and out. I was just flabbergasted. And then he said, oh, it was really interesting one night because he had this kind of like spotlight that would go on with movement. As a moorport came into the big gum and was sitting there and it was actually chasing the bats. So he could see when the light would flash on when the moorport came past and the bats were shooting off.
Wow.
It was just like, you know, kind of like...
Just having David Attenborough in your backyard.
Yeah, yeah. And he was just, you know, he just said it so commonly, like it was something that happened, and I'm just standing there gaping going, oh, yeah. And so in the end, we just kind of took off some of the branches towards the house and then just left the rest of it.
Another stopgap measure to replace old native trees is artificial bat roosts called bat boxes. Selena points one out to me as we're walking along. It looks a lot like a birdhouse nailed to a tree, but instead of a hole at the front, it has a narrow slot running along the bottom where the bats can crawl inside.
That, if I'm not mistaken, is a 50 bat box.
So you could fit 50 bats in that little box there?
Yeah,
they just crunch,
so.
They crunch in, ones. Yeah. Like, wow. They just push up. But they're only, you know, kind of like 8 to 12 grams.
Just,
you know?
Like a tiny little mouse
like
with wings.
The size of your thumb.
Selena and Jerry say the bat boxes have been a surprising success.
You know, the community came together, schools made some bat houses to put up. I think all in all, there were 19 houses, put up mainly as a tool for public awareness in the early days when Hamilton found bats in the backyard.
And it worked.
And, 8 years later, it worked. And we're flabbergasted, really.
Didn't expect it to work.
We were hoping.
A lot of people were kind of, nah, it won't work kind of thing. They were kind of pretty, oh, you know, it's been tried before. Or, you know, yeah, how are they going to find them?
Just as the sun starts setting, we catch up with the fourth and final member of the Project Echo team, Hannah Muller. She's a senior ecologist for the engineering firm Tonkin & Taylor. Hannah's brought along the most critical piece of bat spotting equipment, an ultrasonic transducer.
And it basically just picks up the ultrasound that the bat emits that we can't hear and converts it to something that we can hear when it flies around. Yeah. So at the moment it's just a lot of noise coming out, unfortunately. We'll see if we pick something up.
So what does it sound like when a bat comes by?
Sort of like a high-pitched click.
Oh, yeah.
That's quite distinct.
Hannah uses these transducers in her work to make sure no bats are hurt when trees have to be knocked down to make way for a new road or housing development. That job involves a lot of clambering around trees and peeking into holes, which often brings her face to face with some of the bats' worst enemies, introduced predators like rats and possums, which also like to live in holes inside trees.
We always keep a track on what we find, of course, when we do our surveys, but we don't often get the chance to do extra research on these sort of things, so we always take note on what's going on whenever we're out in the field.
Because, I mean, bats are so small and quick, it's sort of hard to imagine, like, a cat or something managing to stalk up on one like they do on birds sometimes.
They don't really have to. They can, because they roost in a cavity in a tree,
So if a cat or predator can get to that roost and get in it, the bats are going to be still and they can get as many as they want.
Right.
But also the bats have to drink. So when they come down to a pool of water, and that's how cats can get a lot of birds, even native pigeons, kereru, they just wait at the water holes. They learn where the water holes are, that the birds and bats...
Oh, there's one.
Oh, wow, you can see it. Yeah, just saw a wee thing.
Mid-interview, we spot our very first bat.
Oh, that's so cool.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I did.
Awesome.
They're just on the sort of tree line. You can just see them, a sort of little black speck every now and again flies out.
To be perfectly honest, you could hardly see it. It was just a fuzzy little speck fluttering along the tree line. More and more of them came out, and as the light faded completely, we lost track of them against the night sky. But thanks to our fancy bat detectors, we could tell they were all around us. In between the blasts of bat squeaks, I ask Andrew Steisch what people can do to make cities more bat-friendly places.
Predator control is probably the thing. Predator control over a really large area, because these bats are closely associated with bats that are out in the Kakatea stand, out on the plains across the river and well up the river at the Narrows. All of them are associated, so if it can't just be pest control in your backyard. It really has to be the size of thousands of hectares, so hundreds of people, property owners, looking after it. So the predator-free 2050 or predator-free New Zealand, that sort of scale where you have stoats, possums, rats taken out of huge areas, that reduces it. And then I guess trying to stop people just dropping trees all over the place. So set aside really good dark reserves for them close to gullies and rivers. People want to have houses near the river and don't want the trees blocking their view. All of that sort of stuff that people really want to be by the river and really don't want the views blocked, but actually that's really important for some of our wildlife. So it's a big conflict. It's to try and manage the people who want to be near the river and the wildlife that's part of New Zealand, and hoping that the bats can survive it, because they really don't like well-lit places at night. So they tend to avoid them. So spotlights on trees drive them away. So people who love light, that's really bad for bats.
Hamilton and Auckland are the only two places in New Zealand that are known to have long-tailed bats inside the urban area. A few days after my excursion with Project Echo, I drive up to Auckland to meet Ben Paris, senior ecologist for the council. He's also known by his Twitter handle, @NZBatman.
We've found them in the western suburbs around Swanson, coming out of the Waitakere Ranges. We've found them on the edge of South Auckland, and near the Botanic Gardens, but also a lot of them out near Paramahoe, near Pukekohe. We've found them up in the pine forest near Riverhead. Found them further up north on the Kaipara. They're good at hiding in really small forest fragments, and the more we look for them, the more we seem to find.
But still all over the city. Like, how are they sort of managing to sort of move around the city, given it's, not exactly bat-friendly environment?
No. Well, we know a lot about how long-tailed bats move across forest areas like down in Fiordland, where a lot of the research has been done. But we actually don't know a lot about what happens to them moving across urban environments. Will they move across motorways? Will they go across harbours? We don't really know that sort of information yet.
I mean, is there any reason to think they don't? Because I know that they're not particularly fond of the big floodlights and stuff, but...
And yet we've seen anecdotal evidence of bats flying around the pick-and-save floodlights in the car park in Lincoln Road. So these bats can fly up to 30 kilometres normally. So we think that they could probably be coming across Auckland quite regularly, but we just don't know enough about them. We do know that where we have found them in West Auckland is where there's been a lot of stream restoration by the community, and so the streams are really crucial for the long-tailed bat, because they cruise up and down the river clicking and doing the echolocation calls collecting all the little insects that come off the stream at night.
Mm. So the streams are sort of like their little highways almost.
Yeah, feeding highways.
Yeah. And you found them, I mean, recently you found them even inside someone's house.
Yeah, that's right. We had a call from someone that said that they have a bat up under their veranda, and I kind of went, is it really? And then they sent me photos, and yeah, it was. And we went out and had a look, and this little bat has been there apparently 8 to 9 months, and we were really surprised. I contacted Doc, and they said that it's very unusual for this species, but where there's limited roosting availability, then they'll just go find somewhere that's nice and sheltered.
And is that, do you think that's partly because they've done the predator-free thing, so that they actually are reasonably safe hiding under these sort of urban structures?
Yeah, in that particular area in Paramahoe, there's been a lot of pest control there for the past decade, so I think that has really helped, so that the numbers of bats are built up there, so much that we have we did a survey there a few years ago with some contractors, and we had 1,500 bat passes over 10 nights, so that's a lot of bat activity, so that shows us that there is a lot of bats around that area.
Because obviously the bats are considered critically endangered, but do we actually have a good handle on how many there are?
No, not at all. We just don't have enough population data to find out what's happening, and this is why we started the bat survey and tracking work that we did in the Waitakere Ranges, which was to try and find out what was happening with the population in the Waitakere Ranges. Because my biggest fear is that because these bats live up to 30 years, that we were just seeing the old male bats flying around, and that the females had been victims to predation at the maternity roost. We were really pleased when we've caught a couple of post-breeding females in our last lot of summer catching, so we're going to try again next summer and put little transmitters on them and see if we can follow them back to where they're going, back to their other maternity roosts.
Do you think that's sort of some encouragement that sort of, you know, over these last 10 years or so, we've discovered these bats can tolerate the urban environment? I mean, that sort of would seem to be good news for their long-term survival.
It would seem that way, but as I said, these bats live for 30 years, so these bats may be just hanging on and the populations may not be breeding. So we need to really look into that to see if these bats are living in isolation or whether they're able to breed between the different forest fragments. And so there's a lot of really important information that we're still lacking that we need to look into to actually help save these bats, because although these little forest fragments don't seem important, especially around Auckland where there's the housing problem and we're expanding our city, these bats are stuck in these little tiny little forest fragments, so that means that we have to try and find ways of having them live in these areas and while still having our housing around them as well.
And as you say, still linking those fragments together so that you don't, you know, if you have one problem in one little patch of forest, it doesn't wipe a whole population out.
That's right, and that's why we're trying to work on at the Auckland Council is Northwest Wild Link, which is trying to create a continuous green corridor from the Waitakere Ranges across to the Hauraki Gulf Islands, so that at least birds and bats can link between the different forest fragments so that they can breed more successfully and travel across these areas safely.
Are you sort of surprised by how excited people get about bats? Because you know, I ran across this sort of bat fun day they were holding, and, you know, there were about 40 people all sort of, you know, very happily chattering away and looking up at the sky and everything. And you don't really think of that kind of excitement about bats.
No. I've been really surprised that people have been so excited about bats and wanting to know more about bats and get bat detectors and look for them in the backyards and schools and golf courses. We had a bat fun day recently and over 300 people turned up, and we were really surprised that
300, really?
Yeah, it was just amazing that so many people were interested in bats and just want to find out more about them.
I guess it's sort of the mystery factor of them too, because, you know, you've probably seen a tui or, you know, a weka or something if you've gone into the bush at some stage, or, you know, wood pigeons, stuff like that. Most people never ever seen a bat or even think they could.
Exactly, and our bat walks book out faster than an Adele concert. You know, they're gone in about 20 minutes, And it's just really cool that because people just want to go out into these bat walks and people are just amazed to see these bats. And it's just a real special experience because most people don't even go out in the bush at night. So to see these little tiny bats is a real special moment.
I mean, they do provide some ecosystem services too. I mean, I hear they're pretty big fans of mosquitoes, which is nice to know.
Yeah, and over in the States, they've done all sorts of research that shows that these long-tailed bats, they're micro-bats anyway, are able to provide agricultural pest control for them and their crops. They actually put bat roost boxes against their house so they control the mosquitoes in the summer as well. So I think that overseas they've got the right idea, so we just need to try and get better at living with our long-tailed bats.
Wants to get a good recording.
Thanks, William. That story was produced by William Ray, and thanks too to everyone who took part in it. I'm Alison Balance, and this Our Changing World podcast first aired on RNZ National on the 30th of August 2018. Our webpage is rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld, and you can do all sorts of things there. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter, find our contact details, and browse through our very large audio archive, which goes back to 2008. Search for bats, for example, and you'll find stories about our other bat species, the short-tailed bat. We are RNZ Our Changing World on your favourite podcast provider, and you can also find us on the RNZ app. Stay in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook, where we are RNZ Science. Bye for now. Ngā mihi.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.